You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you by Total Wine and More. With locations in Santa Fe and Albuquerque, each store has about 8,000 different wines from all over the world, and thousands of beers, including both major brands and microbrews and imported beers. And they have more than 3,000 different kinds of spirits, all at the lowest prices you'll find, and with a trained, knowledgeable staff. They're on the web at totalwine.com, and you can order for in-store pickup. And if you use my promo code, you can save even more. Use code 6979 at the store or online and receive $10 off on your next $50 purchase. That's code 6979. Thanks again to Total Wine and More for sponsoring the Radio Cafe. We're going to be talking today to Alejandro Madrazo Laju and Catalina Perez Correa. They're both Shell Human Rights Fellows at Yale Law School and professors at CIDE Research University in Mexico, where Alejandro founded the Interdisciplinary Drug Policy Program. He's argued legal cases that contributed to making abortion and same-sex marriage legal in Mexico. Catalina is a member of the International Research Consortium on Drugs and the Law, which she was the head of for 6 years. They recently gave a talk in Santa Fe called The Mexican Paradox, sponsored by the Angelica Foundation. It was part of the Center for Contemporary Arts series Mexico Today, which includes lectures, a great art exhibition of the work of Ricardo Masal, and all kinds of festivities. You can find out more about that at ccasantafe.org. So in the conversation with Catalina and Alejandro, we're going to hear about the extraordinary moment in Mexico that is happening right now. And in the first 10 minutes or so of our conversation, Alejandro will give a brief history of Mexican politics since the 19th century. So please stay with us through that, because it's maybe a little dense, but it paints a picture of the political and cultural dynamics that led to the current moment. All of which I find to be really interesting and important, because in so many ways, Mexico is a mirror of the United States. Both countries are large American democracies with both state and federal governments. They both have a long history of inequality and violence, but also real progress. They have indigenous and colonial histories that shaped both countries' identities, and both have problems of drug wars, corruption, and challenges to democracy. And I think that the more we recognize our similarities and our own respective strengths and weaknesses, the better we'll be able to honestly address and start to solve our problems, both individually and as neighbors. So let's go now to Alejandro Madrazo Laju and Catalina Perez. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here and excited.
Yes, thank you for the invitation.
So let's talk about the recent Mexican election. Andrés Manuel López Obrador, also known as AMLO, was elected after two previous unsuccessful tries, though it's arguable that he did win in 2006. But this time he was elected in a landslide. What has changed in the last couple of decades that led to this election? Give some background.
I think this, in many ways, is the culmination of a period that you could consider the transition into democracy for Mexico. So you can make different historic cuts to try to explain this. And I think that the way AMLO is speaking of his election, he's speaking of it as the fourth great transformation in Mexican history, referring to independence, the reform, which in the middle of the 19th century separated church and state, and the revolution at the beginning of the 20th century, his being the fourth, right? So the narrative that he's constructed and the importance he gives to his own election through that narrative warrants going back a little bit further than the last 20 years. So let me take a step back and say this. Mexico had a very hard time establishing a functional state that was stable, that was territorially stable. I mean, we lost a lot of territory during the first few decades after independence, both north and south, notably New Mexico.
Right, where we're sitting.
Where we're sitting. But then in the second half of the 19th century, the government sort of stabilized and the modernization of the economy was put in place through government steering. And there was a lot of development during that period. Infrastructure, Mexico was integrated into the world economy in many different ways. But one of the things that characterized that period, the end of the 20th century in a dictatorship called the Porfiriato, is that it didn't redistribute either power or money. actually concentrated power and money. And so at the beginning of the 20th century, there was a major social upheaval that we globally call the revolution, but in fact was several regional convulsions that led to a grand civil war for about 10 years in Mexico. And there, something very important began happening. The construction of citizenship in Mexico really began. So the 19th century kind of constructed the state, and then we began constructing citizenship in a very peculiar way. So usually we think of the rights that citizens exercise as progressing from, you know, the civil and political rights into social rights, social and economic rights. In Mexico, it was the other way around. The first rights that were actually relevant were labor rights and agrarian rights. And that led to a huge redistribution in Mexico.
Redistributing land or?
Well, during the first period, redistributed land importantly, during the period of the only left-wing president then, Lázaro Cárdenas, there were major land redistributions. Then that kind of dwindled away. So after that economic advancement that you could say was widely shared, there was a small problem, and it's that the political system was deeply closed. There was basically a one-party hegemonic system with the PRI, and what started happening is that the generation that had been born under the prosperous period of economic development started demanding also political rights. So all good for social and economic rights, but we would also like our vote to count, right? So what youth and unions started demanding in the late 50s and especially in the 60s was, you know, better political rights. Votes should count, the media should be far more free to speak, etc. And so we had, you know, the 68 movements with students that ended with major repression in Mexico City, and that triggered the beginning of the opening of political rights. And that process was slow at the beginning. It was managed very much by the government, and it led us from a one-party system to a one-party system with a couple of real opposition parties hovering around, but not with the capacity to actually take power in an election. And elections were not precisely, well, thought of as legitimate or as true. Then there was a major crisis because the PRI split in two in 88. And after 88, and especially in the 90s, there was a negotiation to establish a good electoral system. And by 97, we had a good electoral system and credible elections. And that led very quickly to the party losing first the majority in Congress and then losing the presidency in the year 2000.
Vicente Fox.
And so the narrative of democratization seems all happy. But then something happened under Vicente Fox. The first thing is that What didn't happen with the transition is that there was no overhaul of the whole repressive apparatus of the state. The police system, the Attorney General's office as a political body, the justice system, the prison system were not reformed. They had been developed during a period in which they were basically used to suppress political or social dissidents, and they remained so. With a different party in power, but the whole justice and security apparatus, which was relatively small, but was still very authoritarian. So that's what didn't happen with Vicente Fox. What did happen is that the electoral system started closing and trying to block the left-wing party from winning the election. By that point, López Obrador was mayor of Mexico City. He was clearly the favorite to win the 2006 election. And he was very actively blocked by both government and the economic elite from running first. They tried to keep him from running, and then during the election, from winning the election. And they succeeded. He did not win the election. It was a very questioned election. And because it was a questioned election, the candidate that did win, Felipe Calderón, seemed very weak and illegitimate in many ways. And out of the blue, you had a couple of regions in Mexico, Michoacán and Tamaulipas on the border with the U.S., where violence had become more visible and more gory. So, for example, there were decapitations in adjustment between the mafias, public display of bodies when there were, you know, drug murders. That hadn't happened before, and that was very visible. And Calderón jumped on the fear that that had impressed on the Mexican population and launched the war on drugs. And the war on drugs, which was supposed to be temporary and very small at first, became basically a major overhauling of the whole security apparatus of the Federation, militarizing it and centralizing it in the federal government. And thus began the catastrophe that we've had in the increase of murders and the rampant violence we've had in Mexico. And so during the Calderón period, which we went from being a particularly peaceful country for the region, for Latin America, to having the highest growth in the rate of homicides. I mean, really an epidemic of violence that we had not seen since the last time we were in civil war 100 years before. That catastrophe led to the defeat of the party that had governed under Fox and Calderón, the right-wing party. However, López Obrador was still seen by many as too radical in the left because he had proposed a very aggressive economic agenda of redistribution. And so he ended up as runner-up, and the PRI was brought back to power in 2012. The idea was that they know how to govern. And what happened was that they didn't. They didn't manage things well, but what they did do was have one of the most corrupt governments in Mexico. So the 2018 election comes at a time at which the right-wing party is discredited because it got us in the mess of the war on drugs. And the PRI, which used to be the center party, is discredited because it didn't get us out of the war on drugs. It actually deepened the militarization and therefore expanded the wave of violence. We are at the highest level, homicide level rate in our history. We have 25 homicides per 100,000 inhabitants right now. And in 2006, when the war on drugs began, we had 8. So we went from 8 to 25. That's no mean feat. And so in 2018, the two parties, of the three parties that actually were contending, two parties were completely discredited because of corruption and the war on drugs. And the only character that had positioned himself as an opposition to the current government and the current policy was López Obrador, who was speaking of redistribution and who was speaking of peace. What I think nobody expected, I mean, everybody thought that he was a strong runner and might win. Nobody expected the landslide. And the landslide is not minor. And that's why I think he have to pay attention when he speaks of a fourth transformation. Because his party, which is actually a new party, which was founded in 2013, went from having 8% of the vote in 2015 to reaching 53% of the vote in 2018. It won the presidency. It won both houses of Congress. It won 19 out of the 32 local Congresses. And it won 5 out of the 9 governorships that were up for grabs in this election. So it represents a major shift in the political map in Mexico. But a major shift that is inscribed in the narrative, which he explicitly speaks of, as engaging the whole of Mexican history.
So I really appreciate your giving us this history of Mexico because, and this is something that we often fail to do in the United States, is contextualize any given election or any given situation in a much longer history of our country. You now have, let's call it, a new phase of the democracy movement or the democratization of Mexico, and that is all about redistribution of rights, perhaps of wealth, economic development, but you're still working with this failed war on drugs, which is still with us, and the kind of physics of power where you have these drug cartels, you have organized crime, you have a flow of guns from the United States, you have a flow of drugs into the United States, you have corrupt and complicit politicians, business people, and military, and all of those are forming a kind of anti-democratic ecosystem. First of all, what does that actually look like? Like, what is that physics of power? Let's talk about that first, and then what are some ways that Mexico is addressing it?
So I just wanted to add something to the point that Alejandro was making. So we have this country right before this election where there's rampant corruption from the PRI, the war on drugs, as you said, and huge inequality, right? So in 2017, Mexico was the last place of all the countries measured in the OECD in terms of inequality. Chile was the second worst. But I mean, we have a lot of inequality, and we have a lot of research that shows also that inequality is not just a problem of justice, it's also a problem for social peace. The more unequal societies are, the more violence that there is. And so the difference in discourse that AMLO had, he basically addressed those three issues during his campaign. He talks about there will be no corruption. We have to get rid of corruption. We have to deal with inequality, and we have to have a country that enters a peace process. This last point, the peace process that AMLO was talking about, there was a change of discourse in terms of ending the war on drugs. And so there's the idea that they will regulate drugs. And first they've talked about any drugs, and then they've said, okay, we're going to only talk about cultivation of poppy seeds, and we're going to regulate cannabis. And there's also an idea of a transitional justice and a peace process. And it involves, first of all, recognizing that we have been outside a state that's a normal state. We have to transition from what we have, which is a civil conflict, into something different, a constitutional state.
What would you compare it to? I mean, when you talk about transitional justice, you're talking about, I mean, truth commissions as they've had in absolutely war-ridden African countries, that kind of thing?
They've talked about truth commissions. They've talked about amnesties, which was actually one of the main criticisms that the other candidates made against AMLO was the idea of amnesty. He was saying one of the things that we said is we can't continue with the war. We need to start talking about pardoning each other and talking to each other. And I think that sounded better for a lot of people. And so, yes, one of the ideas are truth commissions, the idea that we need to, you know, bring forward the people that have been accused, bring forward the victims, and get people to confess the crimes that they have committed, to understand. We have 30,000, that's only official data. Unofficial data gives a higher number of disappeared people. 30,000 people that have disappeared and nobody knows where they are. They have families, and these families need to know where their brothers or sisters or fathers or mothers are. And so part of the idea of the Truth Commission is to get perpetrators to come forward and confess, and in exchange have a reconciliation process, which includes some type of amnesty, which maybe it's a reduction of the sentences. It's not clear yet. They're actually starting forums to talk about what this process actually implies. But there are many countries that have had these type of processes. South Africa is one, Argentina, Chile. Some have been more successful, some have been less successful. The case of Argentina, for example, what they did was they basically got the high-ranking military and said, okay, well, you confess to your crimes, and in exchange for that, we're just going to pardon you and we're going to forget what you did. And that made a lot of people angry. So here the idea is we need to put the victims first and we need to know the truth. And the other thing is, this process is very important to understand, and this goes to your question. What are the structures that are allowing the mafia state and for the things that have been occurring to continue occurring? So who has been participating in this? How do they participate? And the idea is we need to understand it in order to be able to take it apart.
It's very tricky because there are many problems in the failed war on drugs that were caused, as you explained very eloquently, by bad policy. And they can, to some extent, be addressed by better policy. You're talking about the regulation of drugs. Does that include, by the way, like decriminalization of drugs, or what are you actually talking about?
No, for cannabis, at least, the idea is to regulate from something like what Canada's done, or Uruguay, which is from cultivation, from production, to the sales and use. The war on drugs, when you look at it, and this isn't just Mexico, if you look at it in the United States or in the rest of Latin America, what you see is it's basically a tool by which the state is going against certain sectors of the population. In the case of Mexico, and I think it's similar here in the United States, it's, you know, the young men who really have no space, or who haven't found the space within the state. You know, there's no educational possibilities for them. There's no work for them. And the state doesn't know what to do with them. And I think one of the things that we see is, in the case of Mexico, you have a state which has a very bad reputation for all the crimes that they have committed in terms of repression and corruption. It has been absent, you know, in terms of providing health services, or the health services that they provide is very limited. There's no education, but they do appear with the military eradicating crops, or with federal police detaining young men and taking them to prison. So the way that the state is present in Mexico is very violent. And I think one of the ways to address, you know, we need a new type of state and a new relationship of the Mexican state with its citizens can begin with changing drug policy. And of course, it's not going to be enough to pacify the country or to change the mess that we're in, but it's a good start. And I think the fact that there's a change in discourse, which is saying we need a different relationship of the Mexican state with people, you know, it was very attractive, and it is very attractive to a lot of Mexicans.
So change in drug policy, legalization, regulation, better health care, better education, all of those kind of things that you're talking about. At the same time, I mean, you have a situation caused by really bad policy. And I think you were talking the other night about, in a sense, the war on drugs was kind of outsourced to Mexico by the United States. And I'd love you to talk more about that. But I mean, once you have these massive amounts of guns and mafias and cartels and the militarization of the police, or the taking over of policing by the military, those institutions are a lot easier to create than they are to destroy.
Completely. Completely. I mean, we're in a major mess. It took us a very short time to get into this mess. It was the result of a few very poor decisions. But the damage done over the last 12 years of war on drugs in Mexico is going to be very difficult to deal with, and it's going to take generations. When I started working on drug policy, most people were still thinking that the militarization would work, that having a strong hand and a strong arm against the criminals would eventually have them wind down the violence. And what I kept telling people is, man, if you think it's bad now, imagine how it's going to be when the kids who were 10 when the drug war began and who are 16 by the time the Calderon administration finished grew up. Imagine when they're 30. Yeah. That's when we're going to reap the seeds that we've been sowing. So it is going to take a long time, and the drug war was a sufficient condition for getting us into this mess, but it is not a sufficient condition for getting us out of this mess.
When you say, what is the necessary method of getting us out?
Regulating drugs.
Okay.
Abandoning prohibition.
Right.
You know, the resources that we invest in running after what is basically cargoes of weed and cargoes of cocaine, most often making it stay in Mexico, because as you mentioned, it feels like outsourcing, because, you know, why would we want the cocaine that's going to the U.S. to stay in Mexico, and why do we block it on the roads towards the United States? I don't see any military checkpoints between El Paso and Chicago or El Paso and New York to keep it from getting to the markets, but we have military checkpoints from the point of entry in Lázaro Cárdenas, Michoacán, to Ciudad Juárez, which is where it crosses over to El Paso, right? So it's so evidently a bad policy to invest so many resources on keeping the drugs inside Mexico. Resources that could be invested, for instance, in keeping the weapons, which are fueling the war, out of Mexico. I mean, why are we keeping drugs out of the U.S. instead of keeping the arms that are flowing from the U.S. into Mexico away from Mexico? It really looks like an outsourcing scam, because our resources are better employed in what are our problems. And our problems have to do with illegal gun running in Mexico, have to do with homicide, have to do with kidnappings, have to do with rape, have to do with violence against women, have to do with extortion. Not with drugs. We do not have a major drug use problem. We have the problem of carrying out a policy that is not oriented towards our needs. It's oriented towards the needs of, I'm not going to say of the United States, because I don't think prohibition works in favor of the U.S. either. But the government, the federal government, certainly seems to think so. So we are doing the American federal government's job in keeping drugs within our borders and keep them from crossing into your country.
Although they cross in massive numbers into our country.
Of course.
Because the demand is there.
Of course. And because the border is so large, it's absurd to try to keep it on our side.
I just wanted to go back to this point about what are the other necessary conditions to obtaining peace. I was saying before about these mafia structures that are in place. We often hear about organized crime being the problem in Mexico. But, you know, a recent study, for example, in the north of Mexico that studied disappearances around Nuevo León and Tamaulipas showed that 50% of the perpetrators, or the alleged perpetrators, were authorities, were police, they were Marines, they were the army. And so what we have when we talk about organized crime isn't just these people who are going around in guns and hoods. There's government structures that are part of all of this, and it's going to be very hard to dismantle it. So one of the things that has to be addressed, I think, is the impunity in Mexico and the way that judicial and specifically criminal justice institutions function. Today we have impunity levels of only 1.8% of crimes that are committed actually get solved.
So 98% of crimes.
And they don't make a difference between if it's a homicide or if it's a wallet that was stolen in the subway.
Right. 98% are not solved,
they're never
punished,
solved.
Anything.
No. Some of them may be investigated. It really depends. A lot of the crimes are never reported because people are afraid of the state agents because they belong to organized crime. So if you're a victim of, you know, your daughter disappeared because a commando took them and you saw that they were part of the federal police because the uniform was, or you think that they were, if you go to the attorney general's office and say, you know, the federal police took my daughter, chances are they're going to come back to you and say, we told you to keep quiet, or you should keep quiet because then you're next. And so there's no agencies where people can go, or there's no authorities where people can go and denounce crime. So that's part of the problem. One of the projects that has been pending in Mexico is the creation of an autonomous attorney general's office. One of the things that we're waiting to see is whether during AMLO's administration, whoever's going to be heading that agency will really be autonomous and independent of all the ties to the party and to political interests. The other part that I think is very important is the demilitarization of public security in Mexico. And actually, people from AMLO's new cabinet have talked about the importance of demilitarization. They've given a 3-year period to bring soldiers back into the barracks. We don't know if 3 years is enough or not. I think we need a better diagnostics to know what's happening around the country. But I think this goes back to something that Alejandro had said. Calderón in 2016 decided to send soldiers to Michoacán to deal with the violence that was happening there. There was about 6,000 soldiers that were sent there. And then there was another 3,000 sent to Tamaulipas a few days later. And then they were sent to Chihuahua. And then by the end of the first year and a half of the Calderón administration, we already had 50,000 soldiers on the ground. And just to, you know, Mexico is a big country, but we have approximately 20,000 federal police on the ground at a given time. So, you know, we have a lot more military than we do federal police. And one of the things, well, several things have happened with the presence of the military. One of them is violence has fueled, because every time there's a shootout, there's the escalation of the weapons that we were talking about. So if the military appears with better weapons, then the organized crimes get better weapons, and that leads to more violence.
That's just an arms race.
It's an arms race.
But it's more than an arms race. It's not only the weapons. It's the training, and it's the stability of the forces there. The military can go in for a few weeks, maybe a few months, and then get out. So they function as an army of occupation. They're not a body that is there to keep the peace throughout and permanently. And second, they're not trained to do police work. They're not trained to detain people. They're trained to shoot people and kill people. And that is reflected in the statistics that Catalina has worked on.
So, I mean, the military is a body that's worked on national security. And so they see people as enemies of the state or friends of the state. Whereas when a police is trained, they see citizens who have broken the law and who need to be detained and brought before a judge to answer for the crimes that they have committed.
It's such an important point that you're making, and I think it's one that we really need to learn here with our police continually ever more militarized and people who are ex-soldiers coming back and joining the police and perhaps often not being properly retrained. The difference between police work and soldiering is absolutely huge. They're different kinds of work. And yeah, they both are trained guys who go around with guns, but that's really
about it.
So let's just go back to the Mexican context. We have the civil authorities who are very corrupt and who people fear, because the police sometimes work for the cartels, or you don't know exactly who's who and who's the good guys and who's the bad guys. And you have the military who come in and start replacing civil authorities. And so what we have in many parts of Mexico today is that municipal police have completely disappeared, or there's just a few members of the municipal police, but they're not really functioning to do public security. So who's taking care of people who don't cross stop signs, or who's taking care of a woman who's beaten in her house? Well, we have a vacuum of that part of the state, which is a very important part of the state.
Both the on-the-ground policing and the investigative agencies.
Yes.
Both on-the-ground policing and investigative agencies. And I would say also, for the vast majority, the judiciary. And this is something that you have to understand. I mean, the drug war just put everything on crack, so to speak. I mean, just really took everything to a whole different level in terms of volume, intensity of violence, the discourse of criminalizing citizens, etc. But the distrust of the civil population towards its authorities had been longstanding, precisely because we had very poor investigative agencies, very poor police, and very poor judiciary. Their jobs were never really done. And the transitions that Mexico underwent in the 80s and 90s were a major economic overhaul, moving away from a state-centered economy into a market-oriented economy, and a democratization process of the electoral institutions. So we changed the economy, we changed the political system, but we left the whole justice apparatus untouched, and it was deficient. What happens with the war on drugs? You take this very pathogenic police and criminal justice system, and you pour tons of money into it, and you give it vast arbitrary powers. And so instead of having a small, dysfunctional, untrustworthy police, investigative, and judicial system, you have a huge militarized monster, which is, by the way, openly against or outside the constitutional regime. The Constitution explicitly states that only civil authorities can do public security. But you deploy massively 50,000 soldiers, you know, people notice that on the street, even in so we live in Aguascalientes, which is the second safest capital in the country. And yet every day, not every day, but every few days, I have to sit in traffic behind a heavily armed gun pointed at me, managed by a police officer with a mask on him. And so that presence of that beast, which was not very trustworthy before, but which is now huge, really shakes things up and really gives you the notion that you are completely unprotected by the law, because the Constitution is saying only civil authorities, but you have the military deployed for 12 years throughout, I think it's 23 states out of the 32 states, with 50,000 troops on the ground. And we all know that that's outside the Constitution. So how can you claim to be enforcing law and claiming that you're going to make the rule of law effective and fight criminals when you're openly violating the Constitution for 12 years?
So basically, you have a new president who is a man fighting Bigfoot, Godzilla, King Kong, and a bunch of like dinosaurs on steroids. And that's a job that's really, I mean, it's huge. And of course, he's having what so many people are calling his Obama moment right now. And people are excited and they're looking forward to more democracy, more peace. Not only does he have this almost impossible job to do, and we were talking recently to Lidia Cacho, the journalist who said, you know, Mexicans love to have somebody they put on a pedestal and then when they're not a superhero, knock them off. Meanwhile, presumably there's some internal opposition. I mean, when Obama was elected and legitimately elected by a very clear margin, these people led by Mitch McConnell and people of that ilk formed kind of a phalanx to, I mean, if Obama had said puppies are cute, there would have been an opposition to cute puppies. I mean, it was like anything he did was vilified. And then you, as Mexico, have to deal not only with internal opposition, which maybe you can tell us how much of that there is, if there is any, against the new president, but also then external opposition from the United States.
Yeah, no. I mean, just in terms of, for example, this proposal to regulate drugs and cannabis, there's a lot of people against it inside of Mexico. We've been pushing for drug law reform for several years, and there's a lot of prejudice against the idea of regulation. But as you say, I mean, the first news that came from the U.S. was the U.S. would not support this. And we don't exactly know what the president would do, the U.S. president would do right now in terms of he doesn't support a policy where drugs are regulated. What would that mean? So there is opposition. There's also the conservative parties within Mexico who are upset with the liberal agenda, gay marriage, abortion, women's rights, and also the economic technocrats who are very nervous about what does it mean. I mean, one of the slogans that AMLO used during his campaign this time around, but also in the previous one, was for the good of all, first the poor, right? So he's talking about redistributing wealth. We're not really sure, again, what the policies of redistribution mean, but that's making a lot of people nervous.
Right.
Yeah, I think, I mean, so the comparison to Obama is difficult in many ways. I mean, of course, he's in a honeymoon and he's in an Obama moment, undoubtedly. And there's so many people that have opposed him just for being him over 12 years since he first ran, that certainly if he said there were cute puppies, a lot of people who oppose him will still say, you know, I'm against cute puppies, right? However, there are many differences. And one difference which is not good, I think, in the Mexican context, but which will work in his favor, is that we have a, if you guys have an, how can I put it, a looming presidential figure, ours is gargantuan. Yeah. Our presidential institution is symbolically very powerful. So just by stepping in there, the opposition towards him has been reduced massively. I mean, the discourse of the media that really worked on hitting him hard during the election and for years had basically a defamation campaign against him switched the day he won the election. Second, he won the election by such margins that if they think that they're just going to oppose him by standing in front and forming a phalanx, they're wrong. Now, what is a good check on him is that I think we have a civil society that is far more active today and far more organized than it ever was. And part of it is because of the failures of the two administrations under the drug war. The government wasn't doing its job at finding information, at reporting information, at finding bodies. And what happened is that mothers went out and found bodies, and reporters actually carried out their independent investigations on corruption and proved the corruption schemes. Academia started producing the information that the government didn't produce. So we have a far more active civil society, which by and large, I think, supported him during the election, but will also be critical of him once he's in there. And another thing that's happened that's very interesting and that is happening right now and never happened before is that his political leadership was characterized by being very monolithic and personalistic throughout his whole career. He was the big figure, he was the dominating figure, and everybody around him had to stay one step behind and couldn't be up front and couldn't be shining. What has happened in the last few months, and especially since they won the election, is that this very complex, very diverse cast of characters around him that have been recruited and announced and tapped for different ministries are going out and speaking publicly to civil organizations and to entrepreneurs and to universities, but doing so in public. And they're also making public their own opinions even when they disagree with him. So his former campaign manager, for example, just openly spoke against the appointment that was announced for the Federal Electrical Commission, which is the monopoly in electricity in Mexico. So the soon-to-be president announces an appointment, and the same day his campaign manager says, by the way, I disagree with that appointment.
So that could be considered a healthy diversity of opinion. It could be considered chaos.
I don't think it's going to be chaos because of how looming the presidential institution is. I mean, when he needs order, he will have order within his team. But I think it is positive because there's diversity. For example, the first announcement that the government was considering seriously regulating cannabis was made by his soon-to-be Secretary of the Interior, which is the key post in the cabinet. And the first time she announced it as her opinion. And then the second time she announced it, she said publicly, you know, and after I made that announcement, I spoke to the candidate and he's behind exploring the possibility. And so you even have them speaking out on major public policy issues before getting his approval. And that feels healthy right now because everything was so hermetic in the previous governments. Like the attitude of the government was, we know how to do it and we know how to do it better. And if you don't agree with us, then you're not part of our team. And they were suspicious of all critics. These guys are actually reaching out to critics. And I can tell you that at a personal level. I mean, when their platform for security came out in December, we went wild criticizing it because it is a very poor platform, what they published in December. And throughout the campaign, what they insistently did was try to reach out and get the criticisms and, okay, you know, could you send documents? And that is a very fresh feeling from the government because for years, the people that have been engaged in producing information, producing diagnosis, etc., would be not only ignored by the decision makers, but also put down publicly when we came out with data that was uncomfortable. And that, I think, is a healthy shift.
So one of the things that I think many Mexicans are looking forward to is really focusing on communities, on the needs of Mexicans, on health, on education, on economic development, which has also been left behind in the face of all this violence, on creating good jobs for Mexicans so that, as AMLO said, if they want to migrate, but they don't have to migrate, one can imagine with the right policy over time, good jobs with better wages for Mexicans so that they would stop migrating to the United States, which would be really tricky for the United States because we depend so much on Latin American labor and are quite hypocritical about that.
Yeah, no, I also think there's a core responsibility which isn't really seen. Your president often talks about, you know, there's a core responsibility, but the Mexican aren't doing their job. And I think, you know, one of the things that Alejandro was talking about before is all the guns that the U.S. is allowing, and they're being sent to Mexico and into Central America. And the money that is being put into certain programs like the Mérida Initiative and the Plan Colombia. And they're fueling violence in these places. And that also is forcing people out of their homes and into the U.S. And I think this idea of co-responsibility has to change in terms of the programs that the U.S. has, both in Mexico and other countries in Latin America, Central America, have to be reared towards getting better development in those areas and making better work conditions instead of fueling these programs that are just making violence worse and displacing people from their homes.
Let me put it this way. I'm no expert in immigration policy, and I may be looking at it from the lens of drug policy. So I said before that in many ways, the U.S. policy regarding drugs towards Mexico seems like an outsourcing scam, because we're putting the bodies to keep the drugs out of your country, and you're not following that same policy to keeping the drugs out of your markets. I mean, once the drugs cross your border, they safely and violently reach communities, and then the war on drugs is cracked on selected communities on the consumer side of the equation, right? So nothing happens between El Paso and Baltimore, but then black neighborhoods in Baltimore get bashed with the war on drugs, right? But there's no effort to keep the cocaine flowing from Ciudad Juarez all the way to Baltimore at all. So that looks like a scam. So I may be biased, but when I look at immigration policy and the relationship between Mexico and the United States, what I see is another scam. And the scam I see is the following. We've been for years integrating our economies with the idea that we can have free flow of services and products, but not labor. Yet, your economy depends to an important degree in certain sectors on labor that we send over across the border. Now, the scam is the following. By not recognizing American dependence on that labor and formally recognizing it and giving work permits, temporary work permits, few years work permits for that labor to move into the United States and then move back to Mexico, the US economy is saving a lot of money from paying full wages, from paying full, you know, everything else that goes with the wages, you know, the
insurance,
everything. And that makes work cheaper in the U.S. And the way to do that is to label these people as illegal. And because they're illegal, they cannot claim the rights that other workers can claim here. So parts of your economy depend on the scam of calling the labor needed and the labor sought and the labor used as illegal. If we want a healthy relationship in terms of immigration, I think we need to call things by their name. And what it is the U.S. economy needs Mexican labor. And the model that we need to look at is the model when we were actually cooperating on this, which was during the Second World War. The Bracero program was a realistic program because it took labor that was in excedence in Mexico and that was needed in the American economy, brought it over legally, paid full, with all the legal protections, and then the labor could go back to Mexico. And let me tell you something. Most Mexicans that come to the United States for generations preferred to live in Mexico. So they would come and work for a few months while the harvest was going on, or they would come and work for a few years while they saved enough money to buy a house, and then they went back to their families. When did Mexicans start staying massively in the United States? I mean, some stayed, obviously, because you come, you work, and maybe you fall in love, and you stay. But when did Mexicans massively start staying in the United States? When it became a matter of life and death to cross over. Right. If I knew I could, every year I could come over for 3 months and then go back and it was safe, I would go back and forth and have Christmas with my family. But if I'm going to get killed in the process, then I'm staying here and I'm not going to spend Christmas with my family this year, right? So I think that the immigration policy is all a big scam. You guys need the labor. Our economies are integrated to a great degree. Let us recognize the real terms of that integration and give form to it instead of pretending that you guys don't need our workers and don't want our workers, and us pretending that we are actually carrying out the war on drugs because we're concerned about our health. We're not. We're concerned about keeping the U.S. government happy.
You know, I think about the many people who are coming here from Mexico to work, and in my experience, they're often the ones with the most energy and courage and entrepreneurial spirit and kind of adventurous nature. I can't imagine why we would want to send those people back to Mexico, but I can imagine that Mexico would benefit by keeping them. And one of the conversations that you are both really interested in cultivating is about the knowledge that these Mexicans who are living, these Mexican immigrants living in the United States, have and how they can share it and to whose benefit. Talk about that.
So, yes, I mean, one of the things that's very sad for me every time I come to the U.S., and I've lived here three times since I've been an adult, is it's heartbreaking to see that not only are the Mexicans who come here hardworking and entrepreneurial and honest people and good-natured and generous, but they also keep being more and more educated and more energetic and more of them and younger. And it's tough to see such valuable human capital coming over here. However, I do have to say this. There's a lot to criticize about how U.S. institutions work and the criminal justice system here, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's nowhere near as dysfunctional as it is in Mexico. And so most of the people that come over here participate in the system as much as they can. They pay their taxes because the process to pay taxes is actually relatively easy and because they feel more protected when they pay taxes. Whereas in Mexico, they probably didn't pay taxes. Because it's not easy to pay taxes, it's actually costly. You know, if there is some substantial income that's other than your salary, you have to have an accountant to do it. Here they respect traffic signs and traffic rules, whereas in Mexico they don't respect them because nobody respects them in Mexico. There's a different culture of abiding by rules here than there. And the Mexicans that come here are, I think, happy to have a system in which they know that when they can cross the road and when they can pay their taxes and they don't have to fear reporting a crime, for instance, when they don't, sometimes they do. That is a culture of assuming that if you play by the rules, others will also play by the rules. That is not there in most Mexican communities. And what the people that work here show is that we can function very well and very productively under trusting rules. When we are trusted by the authorities, we behave in trusting the authorities and trusting each other. When authorities distrust us, we distrust authorities and all hell breaks loose. And that's something that I think the people that are on this side of the border from Mexico are infusing the Mexican population when they do go back.
That's so interesting. That's a point that I've never really heard anybody talk about. I mean, we talk about the fact that there are migrants and children of migrants who then got into gangs, then they export gang violence back to Honduras and places like that. But exporting from the United States a kind of appreciation for practicing the rule of law. That's a really huge and interesting point.
And it's sad because the more people stay here permanently, the less we benefit from that learned culture. I wish we could have a relationship in which our workers would come for a short period of time and then export that back, you know, with not only with what they tell their families, but also with how they themselves then practice those relationships back in Mexico.
There's an interesting comparison when you think about race relations in the United States, and we have, you know, black, white, and brown, and unfair policing, and the history of slavery, and Mexico is similar in some ways, but really different in many ways. What is racial? Because when you think of Mexico as basically a largely mestizo population, mestizo and indigenous, what does racial inequality look like in Mexico, and what do you think Americans and Mexicans have to teach each other about improving race relations and integration?
Well, one of the things that most called my attention when I first came to study to the U.S. was the sophistication of the analytic tools that law had for understanding racial discrimination. There was a lot of constitutional doctrine on racial discrimination. It was something that was very visible, that was very deeply studied, that you had tools to work with. But on the other hand, your racial practices were absurdly unrealistic. So for example, one of the things that you just mentioned, we think of Mexico as a mixed race population, but you don't think of the U.S. as mixed races. You think of races as being discrete. You're either black or white. You don't speak of mulatto as a category that is real. And just to give a very ostensive example, if you were speaking of Barack Obama in Mexico, you wouldn't speak of him as a black man. You would speak of him as a mulatto, because that's what he is. Mulatto is the son or daughter of a mixture between black and white races, right? But that category doesn't even exist in the US. So the brown doesn't come from the mixing of the races. The brown comes from an introduction of a third race, right? So you have great analytic categories to understanding your racism, but you have terrible practices which reinforce that racism because they artificially sustain the races that really are no longer. I mean, a good portion of your population is mixed race. It's neither black or white or brown, but mixed race. On the other hand, we have great practices regarding mixing of races.
Like in Mexico.
In Mexico and in Latin America in general, and particularly in the Caribbean where it was most intense, in the sense that it is pretty normal for interracial marriage. And families and extended families are multiply raced, and that's normal. And that's there's nothing too obsessive about keeping the races apart, as you guys have here.
I mean, I noticed in Cuba, there's not even a category called interracial marriage. It's
right.
Just called marriage.
It's just called because basically probably 90% of the marriages are interracial marriages by now. Mexico is less intermixed than Cuba because of the proportions of the races were not as balanced as in Cuba and in the Caribbean. But it certainly there is a lot of mixing of races, and we think ourselves as all of us being mixed race. And there's the problem. We don't have the analytic tools to actually see our racism. And our racism is there because we say we're all mixed blood. But yes, we're all mixed blood, but some are more mixed than others. And there is racism and there is deep racism in Mexico. Yet we have been blinded to that racism by the ideology that stems from our practice of actually intermixing, but which brought with it an ideology in which that intermixing was done and we had no racial discrimination because we're all mixed blood. So I think we need to learn from you your capacity to identify racism and analyze the way it works. And you can learn from us better practices.
So Andrés Manuel López Obrador, AMLO, is about to take office, and it would be great if you guys could come back in a year or two and talk to us again and let us know how it's going. But for now, before we go, what are your hopes in the short and medium run?
Well, I think AMLO has come with a different discourse, and that has made a lot of people have hope for a change. And I guess what we're rooting for is that this discourse becomes policy. And that's what is still to be seen. And that's what we could talk about in a year. How much of the discourse of change has actually become policy?
I would add to that another hope. And that is, I think that AMLO, even though he has a lot of merit for having worked for so many years from the opposition to offering an opposition to the model, I feel, and this may just be my perception, I feel that he didn't produce the demand for change. He catalyzed it because there was nobody else there to catalyze it. But the real demand for change is not his, and it's not his parties. It is Mexican society's. Mexican society is fed up with the failed transition, with the continuing corruption, and with the increasing violence. And many of us who voted for him, I would say most of us who voted for him, voted not because we think that he is ideal and will save us from, you know, whatever, but because we think that he was the better alternative of the ones that were there to actually catalyze change. And the change needs to be pushed for by civil society. So the awakening of civil society that I've seen, and civil society, I mean the indigenous movement in Chiapas, and also, you know, like NGOs specializing on corruption, going after corruption cases in Mexico City with international funding, to, you know, labor unions and agrarian communities,
women's
mobilizing
movements.
Women's movements. This whole panorama that has really become much more active over the last 20 years, that's the real change. It's not having one man in office. He's going to go out of office. But I think there's a cultural change that he catalyzed. And I hope that if the discourse turns into policy, that change will actually gain even more momentum.
Alejandro Madrazo Laju and Catalina Perez Correa, thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
It's been fun.
You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.